Welcome to the Sportscast, November 16th, 2022. If you haven't yet, please subscribe in all our channels, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, and Apple Podcast. You can also listen to us on your smart speaker. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a rating and a review. It will help us out tremendously. We're also on online radio. You can visit us on thesportscast.net or also on Twitter, thesportscast1, and check us. You can check out our app, The Sportscast, for iOS. On the eve of the World Cup, the biggest soccer tournament in the world is coming up in a few days, and we're interviewing authors. Last week, we interviewed Messi versus Ronaldo with Joshua Robinson and Jonathan Clegg. This week, we have Hal Phillips, who's the author of Generation Zero, Founding Fathers, Hidden Histories, and the Making of Soccer in America. Hal, welcome to the Sportscast.
Thank you so much, Santi. It's great to be here.
Hal, so tell us your background with world football.
Well, I played the game my whole life. Played in college, played in semi-pro in the Armageddon of the post-NASL world in the 80s. And I'm a newspaper reporter by trade. And I've been working journalist ever since, I guess, 1986 or seven. But always been interested in soccer. Have done some features for ESPN and different outlets. Written a lot about golf, but soccer is my original and true love. And this book project started around 2014 and was able to publish it finally in July.
Awesome book. It talks about the generation of, I guess it was a key generation of how we got into the sport in America. Tell us a little bit about your book.
I think most people understand that this was not always a soccer country, that anyone who's as old as me, I'm 58 years old, grew up in a very soccer indifferent culture, really. And that has changed. That's obvious. But the question is when and why? And I think a lot of people point to the 94 World Cup when they answer this question. But when I started reporting on it, it really was a different story. It really happened in 1989, that team with Paul Caligiuri, the shot heard around the world, yada, yada, yada. And something has been written about those guys, but I don't think they're given the credit for really laying the groundwork for everything that we enjoy in this modern, diverse, rich football culture we have today. And my question was, why these guys? Soccer had been around for 100 years before these guys showed up. Why did it change? Why? What produced them? What cultural, what cultural environments helped make them possible? So that's what the book ended up being about. And I think it's timely. It's timely because it's amazing to look around American soccer culture and see just how huge it is now. These guys help explain why.
Yeah, I've watched a lot of documentaries on that 1989 game when we qualified for Italia in 1990. Tell us what happened, because back in 1950, we made it into the semi-final of the 1950 World Cup. I believe it was 1950 in Brazil. What happened between then and till 1989? What was that gap all about?
Well, we made the semifinal in the very first World Cup in 1930. We beat England in 1950, but didn't get out of the group. We didn't even win or tie another game in that group. But yeah, starting in 1950, actually starting with the 1954 World Cup in Switzerland, they had formal qualification starting, you know, which meant you had to play everybody in CONCACAF to earn your way in. And when that started happening, our national team wasn't nearly up to the task, but we went 0-9. In the next attempts to qualify for the World Cup. So what happened was when we finally did pull off that massive task in 1989, my question was, well, what produced those players finally? I mean, why them? Why then? Why didn't it happen in 1970? Why didn't it happen in 1965? But the answer is a 20-year story, a 20-year history that I call the modern American soccer movement. And it started in the 70s with the youth soccer revolution, where everywhere across this country, youth soccer leagues introduced the game to little kids. That's how we get people on board for sports and anything in this country. You got to get the kids on board. And that phenomenon actually introduced the game to a broad cross-section of Americans for the very first time. So 1989 comes along, those same kids who were in that revolution grew up, and every single member of that 1989 team played youth soccer in America during the 70s. And oh, by the way, every single member of the women's national team that won the world championship in 1991, every single one of them was introduced by the youth soccer revolution as well. A lot happened in between, a lot of ups and downs, but that 20-year arc is really what my book is about. And without that youth soccer infusion, I don't think it happens nearly so fast, if at all.
Have you ever seen that movie that came out? I think it might've been in, actually 2 years ago. It's called Soccer Town USA. And it was about this neighborhood in New Jersey. And I believe John Hark's came out of it, Tony Miola. Did you see it? And what was your thoughts over that movie?
I did see it. It's excellent. The very first chapter of my book is called Hotbeds, and Kearney, New Jersey, which is home to John Hark's and Tab Ramos and Tony Miola. That one town produced three starters on two World Cup teams. That is the ultimate hotbed right there. But there were hotbeds that propped up all over the place in the 70s and 80s on account of all this youth soccer being played. But Soccer Town USA was a great film. I recommend it to anybody who's an American soccer freak, because it really frames a lot of these dynamics really well. I think, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, John Hark's, Tab Ramos, Tony Miola, every single one of their parents were first generation Americans. They knew the game, and actually they coached those kids up, independent of any kind of U.S. Soccer Federation coaching. There were no academies back then. So you needed an immigrant population. You needed a soccer savvy population to produce players like Tab Ramos. And that's what got it started. But for everyone else, broadly in the culture, they needed to understand the game as a kid. That's how you take, you know, a sporting interest into adulthood. You learn it early.
The North American Soccer League started in 1968, 69-ish, and then ended in 84. Tell us, did that league make an impact for U.S. soccer?
Yeah, but it's really, I think, up for debate whether it was a good impact or a bad impact. Again, when we get back to the question of why us, why I'm a member of Generation Zero. That's why I say us. But, you know, why this population of players and not the population of players directly preceding them? Every single one of those players was groomed as a professional by the North American Soccer League from 1967 to 1984. It produced actual American pros, but when those pros actually got together to play on the national team, they were worthless. Not worthless. They didn't do very well. And why not? Well, I don't want to get into the weeds here, but the North American Soccer League had a quota. You had to have two Americans on the field at all time. And you're like, oh, great, that's a good idea. Well, it is until you realize that they played all those Americans in goal or at left back. They hid them so that there was nobody playing a creative role as an American in the North American Soccer League in the middle of the pitch. And if you don't have those players, you don't have a national team. So the North American Soccer League, I think, was a hindrance. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it folded in 1984, right as all of Generation Zero was becoming old enough to play in it. And these guys just happened to qualify this country for the World Cup 5 years later. I don't think it's a coincidence there. They professionalized themselves. They play in the middle of the park. They develop the skills you need to actually build a national team, not just a bunch of left backs and goalies.
Which NASL, they actually had a team with all Americans. I think it was called Soccer America or America.
Team America.
Yeah, tell us about that. Was that a good experiment?
First of all, I have to shout out to the South Park guys. That movie, Team America, World Police, I just love that movie. That's how you can always remember. But the Team America was 1983. NASL was about to fold. Everyone sort of knew it. But they also knew what we were talking about. In the old NASL, those players weren't getting any time, those Americans in the middle of the field at striker in the skill positions that you need to build a national team worth a damn. And so they put an entirely American team into NASL, which was something that was actually being done at that time in Eastern Europe a lot, frankly, with, you know, hockey teams and soccer teams, putting them in a lower division. So it wasn't a completely revolutionary idea. And, you know, did it work? Well, the league folded in 1984. So, and they pulled the plug on Team America after that one season because the entire franchise was just a mess. All of these franchises were moving and going bankrupt. It was just not a good time. But it was an interesting experiment in getting Americans on the fields, you know, in skill positions. And a lot of those guys did go on to lead, you know, fine careers, although a lot of them were indoors, you know, in the major indoor soccer league. Because when NASL folded, all of those NASL guys went indoors, except for the young guys in Generation Zero who graduated college at that time. And they're like, we don't want to play indoors. We want to play outdoors. There's no league. Oh, we're going to play in the ethnic leagues in Boston and Philly and San Francisco. That's where they professionalized themselves.
There were some options back then. Okay, so gearing up to 1989. I recently saw that FIFA movie on Netflix. I'm not sure if you saw it yet.
I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard good things.
Yeah, Chuck Blazer is in the big part of the movie, of course. I don't know what position you put him. Is he like a godfather of U.S. soccer or not? But he definitely helped out to get the World Cup to USA in 1994, which happened in 88, and the bidders were Brazil and Mexico. Tell us about that and how much of an impact was that?
Well, I don't think any book that's ever been written goes into this process in the depth that mine does, for the record. If you're into that kind of intrigue, some people find it really wonky and boring. But the U.S. started pursuing the World Cup in 1983 when Colombia had the World Cup removed from them by FIFA. And there was a bidding for that 1986 World Cup. That's when Colombia was meant to host it, but Mexico ended up getting it, which is probably a good thing. We weren't really ready to do it. Our professional infrastructure was in tatters at that point. But Chuck Blazer was a very complicated figure. He was involved with the Federation at that time, but not in the courtship of FIFA. His moment came after 1990. One of the things that people kept saying about Chuck was you had to take the good with the bad. This guy was clearly skimming money off the top of all these TV deals that he cut for CONCACAF and the U.S. Soccer Federation. But he was the godfather of soccer on television in this country starting in the 1990s. How old are you, Santi?
37.
A young man. But if you're 58, you remember there was no TV on in this country at all through the 80s and much of the 90s. But then it started, and he was really responsible for a part of that. He was a complicated figure. The guy who really brought the World Cup to this country was Werner Fricker, who was president of the Federation starting in 84. And he really was quite a visionary on this score, but it's a very long and interesting story how they actually got it. I mean, finally, I think FIFA just said, look, we need to get at this market. And the only way to get at it is to give them a World Cup. But, there was an unspoken caveat with FIFA. They said, if you don't qualify for the 1990 World Cup, we may not give you the 94 one. This is a negative you can't prove historically because we did qualify for 1990, but every member of the 1990 men's national team that I spoke to confirmed to me that this was the unspoken rule.
Unbelievable. How? I had no idea. This is like breaking news for me.
It's a juicy bit of historical hearsay that you will only get in Generation Zero, but it's a real thing. I thought, I'm a journalist, Santi. I don't want to get into a bunch of stuff that just isn't true, but when you talk to a dozen guys on the team and they all tell you the same thing, I felt I needed to tell their side of the story.
There's some truth to it. So that pressure to qualify for 1990, how much of the pressure these players have, or that moment they had a good open door, because I don't remember if Mexico qualified for 90 World Cup. I can't remember, but tell us like the vibes, the environment back then in 89.
Well, these were very, very young men who had never played professional soccer, and they were being employed by the Federation in the same way the Federation employed the women's national team up until recently, right? So because there was no good league for them, there was no league at all for them to play in until 1989. So the U.S. Federation secures the World Cup on July 4, 1988, and the national team that has to qualify for the Italian World Cup knows that there's this unspoken pressure to qualify, or else maybe we don't get the 94. Maybe FIFA doesn't follow through. FIFA just pulled the World Cup from Colombia. We know that they can do, We know what they're capable of. So there was an enormous amount of pressure. I think I write in the book that no national team has ever sung for so much supper, you know, in the history of football. So much relied on their qualification for Italia 90. And they were helped out by FIFA in certain ways. Mexico was banned from the 1990 World Cup for using overage players in a couple of youth tournaments in 1987. And that's a very controversial topic still. I'm not sure that it actually, it's a complicated story, but that Mexico's being banned didn't exactly open the door for the U.S. to qualify. But it did winnow the field that they would have had to compete against. We know that. And, you know, the U.S. couldn't score any goals all through 1989. They were an excellent defensive team, but a very young team. And I think they only scored 2 goals in the last 4 games they played. And if they had, and they just barely squeaked in, as we know, and if they had given up 1 goal in those last 4 games, they would not have qualified. So it was very, very tight, very, very dramatic, very, very, as they say, it was a sphincter time, as the English like to say. It was very, very difficult and full of expectation.
Yeah, quite interesting about the whole situation, and you're right. You know, FIFA can pull these hosting bids from anyone. Don't know about, well, now they could have done it with Qatar, but I guess they couldn't do it. Quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. FIFA, it's really hard to reckon. I was doing a show on public radio, actually, yesterday. And people are really upset that Qatar is hosting this event on a certain level. Even soccer fans, it makes them a little heartsick. And I get it. But the problem is FIFA, while it's sort of an organized crime syndicate, actually produces the most compelling sporting product on the planet. That's the problem, is that we love it so much. If they were responsible for the Confederations Cup, or, you know, I don't think people would care. They would just start, but we can't look away. It's the entertainment value, the national pride is too powerful. So here we are, but they were never going to pull it from Qatar. I think their days of pulling events are over, but you know, you can never tell with them. There was certainly a lot of opposition to this event. There remains a lot of opposition to their hosting, but they're making too much money. FIFA is, and Qatar enabled it. So it's hard to see it happening.
Yeah. And when you see FIFA uncovered, it definitely, like, it really blew my mind. It's like, crap, why are we here? But
is it different though? Is it different from the Olympics? Is it different from the money that a host city or country pays to it? It's no different. And why is it weird that we think that is it corrupt that NBC pays the English Premier League millions of dollars, you know, to broadcast those games in the US, and then they sell advertising and they make money off it? Is that corruption? Maybe there's an open bid for that, you know, and it's not as corrupt as the process that FIFA runs, but it's not dissimilar.
Yeah, definitely. We'll see in a couple of years in the background, maybe someone will do a documentary on it. So USA qualifies to Italia. They were last place. They were in the group with Italy, Czechoslovakia, and Austria. No points. They scored a couple of goals, but with that World Cup, how was the aftermath? Was it a positive? Okay, this is going to be, I know we didn't do well in the group, but this is going to be a path forward towards the 94 and the future of the sport in the country.
As I write in the book, Generation Zero, which is really just a fancy word for Generation X, you know, Americans born between 61 and 81, they produce both ends of the spectrum. They produce this golden generation of talent on the men's and women's side. But they also produced all those kids who played, you know, youth soccer in the 70s and grew up playing it throughout the 80s in high school and college. We're talking millions of people. So Italia 90 was a huge event because all those people were able to watch a World Cup for the first time that involved our country. Now, what does that mean? That means these people are finally activated as legitimate soccer fans. It's really the first legitimate soccer fan base this country produced. What does that mean? That means that in 1993, they announced Major League Soccer's formation. That means that they all attended World Cup 94. World Cup 94 was the best attended FIFA event ever, and it still is. all that was Generation X, people showing up to those games en masse because they love soccer. Major League Soccer, you know, launches in 1996. Who made that a success? Generation X, Generation Zero. It wasn't little kids, you know, 37-year-old, no offense. You weren't buying tickets to MLS in 1997. You have to be an adult with cash to do that. So, you know, and I think when they first started, you know, beaming, you know, foreign league play into this country, whose eyeballs were they really going after? Generation Zero. These people had disposable income. They love soccer. That was proven by 1990 and 1994. And away we go. You know, 20 years beyond that, in 2010, I thought, it was really one of the reasons I wrote the book. I was like, something changed here. Soccer actually has made it here. After decades of people talking about this is going to happen, it has happened. When and why did it happen? That's what my book is about.
That's amazing. Back to the television thing. I believe, wasn't Univision that was airing the 86 World Cup? And then 1990, you saw, wasn't like ESPN airing it? Or like, how was like the TV back then?
So in 86, ESPN broadcast, I think, a dozen games. All of them, except for two weekend games where guys sitting in Bristol, Connecticut, just calling them off the TV. So that was the American coverage. Two in-person games and then a bunch of, you know, guys in the studio. Univision did broadcast all the games in 1986, all 52 matches. But it's really hard to get numbers on their viewership. I don't think that Univision bought into the Nielsen system until the 90s. And Univision broadcast all the games in 1990 as well. But the English language partner was TNT, which was a smaller cable, pretty new cable channel at that time. And I think they had 17 million subscribers when they launched. So presumably they had more than that 2 years later in 1990 during the event. But they did not broadcast every game. They broadcast every U.S. game. And I think 28 in total out of the 52, the entire knockout round. I mean, I was a newspaper editor at this time. So I was working at night and I would get up in the morning and watch both games that were on that day. And then I would pack up my briefcase and go into the office at 5 p.m. It couldn't have been better for me because I'd never been exposed to so much World Cup soccer before. It was tremendous. But that was the TV situation back in the olden days.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, I remember that I had to go to bars and watch these games in closed circuit a lot, especially because my parents are Colombian. So I watched like the Colombian games on, you know, go to a bar. It's closed circuit. You had to pay like $20 up front for each person. Same thing for the Premier League. You know, you had to watch pay-per-view, I think, for some Premier League games and some FA Cup matches as well. But right now, you could watch any game around the world. It's easier to watch Premier League matches now than in the UK. So
that is right. And it is really stunning how much it's changed. I mean, you have to pinch yourself as an American soccer fan because, Santi, you hit the nail on the head. From the time I got out of college in 1986 until about 1996, that full decade, you wouldn't believe what I had to do to watch soccer in this country. It just wasn't on. So yeah, you need to find the best Mexican restaurant around that has a dish. You have to find the Italian American club that has a dish. That's a great place to watch soccer, I learned. All the you know, hyphenated American clubs, all those, they were great for watching soccer. I played in an ethnic league for the Greek Sportsmen of Somerville. They had a clubhouse with a dish. So you had to find those places and the restaurants that would let you, you know, sometimes hang out after hours, because who knows where these games were taking place. You know, halfway around the world, it wasn't necessarily business hours. It was a grim reality, and it makes you appreciate the current reality all the more.
Let's talk about the 94 World Cup. A lot of the players from that 90 team, 89, came into the U.S. 94. Tell us about that. Was that a solidifying time for the U.S. soccer?
I think it was. I think it was a, you know, the tipping point was 89. And you're right. The 94 team is held up sort of as the tournament is really held up as the tipping point, not the team so much, because it was really this amazing event with that where they were really worried about, you know, filling stadiums and logistically holding the tournament and televising it properly. That was never a problem. FIFA was like, you know, these Americans, all during the 80s, they would say, these Americans are terrible at football, but they really know how to do television. And 1994 proved that. But yeah, six guys off the 90 team, you know, formed the core of the 94 team. We're talking Parks and Miola and Tab Ramos and Eric Winalda, and I'm going to forget two, but there were six of them. And then they brought in Lawless and a couple other naturalized guys and Ernie Stewart to fill out the team. It was a very good team. But it was an amazing event to witness in this country because people came out of the woodwork. It's still the best attended World Cup in history. It was quite an event, and it made you proud to be an American almost.
Yeah, it was my favorite World Cup to this day. It's my favorite World Cup of all time.
Why?
It was my first one, and like I just like the colors and loved the emotion behind it. I didn't understand it at the time, kind of because I was nine, but I was like, right. Wow, this is amazing. The mascot, the shows, like the intensity. And I did not do any Panini stickers back then, but I don't know. I mean, would you compare 94 bigger than 86 and 90, you know, comparing to past World Cups?
Well, it was a big event here because it was the first real soccer event here. Interesting, if you go back a decade, we hosted the LA Olympics in America in 1984. And that event was really sort of a nothing burger from a soccer perspective competitively. We automatically qualified for that tournament. And they used a bunch of NASL pros to make up the team. And they did not qualify for the second round. They didn't play badly, but no one paid any attention. But one thing that got FIFA's attention was that every single game sold out. Whatever the dozen games were that represented the soccer tournament, that outdrew the rest of the Olympic games in total. So just the soccer event, they put 100,000 people in the Rose Bowl, not just for the gold medal game, but for the bronze medal game. I mean, and FIFA's like, oh, look, what? I mean, they were worried about, you know, having a tournament here in America. They weren't so worried after that. That was really a big moment, I think, for soccer in America, unsung moment.
Yeah, and I think that's why they made the Rose Bowl for the World Cup final for 94. I think that's why they want to keep it there rather than New York or somewhere else. So quite interesting. Soccer today, mm-hmm. how do you see it? Has it grown significantly since that 1989 shot, or we still have more to go?
I think we have more to go, but it has grown every year on year. It is you know, incredible that you know, the soccer culture today in America is, I think, well, I'm continually stunned by it because I grew up in the same culture that was so antagonistic toward it. But if you look at, I think MLS has finally sort of graduated to the role that a domestic competition should take in between World Cups. In every other country, they all love the World Cup in Colombia, but in between World Cups, they pay attention to the first division league there. Everyone has a club they follow. It's huge there. We didn't really develop that, I think, until the last 5 or 10 years with MLS. Good fan culture, you know, for individual franchises, but MLS is only now fulfilling that obligation, you know, to provide a club rooting interest in between World Cups. So that's important. And as we talked about, the television offerings in this country are sick. I think it's probably, this is the best place to watch soccer in the world in terms of options. You know, you can stream anything you want at any time. That's not true in England. It's not true in a lot of very sophisticated soccer countries. So, and what has always been true is that soccer is the biggest participatory sport for kids. That has finally translated into professional culture that is, you know, booming on the men's side and the women's side. I think soccer has replaced hockey as the fourth major sport. It's very difficult to compare them though, because hockey is a big sport, but people in the southern tier of this country don't play it, never played it. They may follow the Carolina Hurricanes or the Florida Panthers, but no one is paying, here's a way to think about it. American hedge fund owners are not like, you know, spending billions of dollars to buy hockey franchises in France. They're not spending that money to buy the Pittsburgh Penguins. This is happening routinely now. You can't get the Swedish league games on a streaming service. That's a good league. I think the second best hockey league in the world is the Russian league. Can you get those games on TV?
Probably not.
I don't think so. It's the international aspect of soccer has allowed it to grow into something unique in the American, you know, media landscape. And I mean, the upside of this is really hard to fathom. Everything else that we associate with pro sports is insular and domestic. The NBA, the NFL, soccer has a different ceiling because of the international quality to it. So I'm pretty bullish, as you can tell.
The 2022 World Cup begins this weekend. U.S. soccer team, majority of the team playing Europe, a lot of them playing top clubs, Champions League. Pulisic is probably the number one best player in the world right now, plays for Chelsea, obviously struggling getting in that starting role. How do you look, how do you see this team compared to 89? Is it a big, big step up, and your thoughts?
Well, it's a huge step up. Let me say first, though, that in 1988, when this team that I wrote about came together, there wasn't a single American playing in an overseas league. That is another thing that Generation Zero pioneered. They went to Europe first and made a name for American soccer before the World Cup in 1990. And then afterwards, they all played in Europe. So I just got to give them a little plug. I write about it a lot, but I love the 2022 team. This is the youngest, most talented team I have seen. We have never produced a midfield like we have today. Tyler Adams, Weston McKinney, and Musa. Each one of those guys would represent a generational upgrade on his own. And now we have three of them. They're all less than, 24 years old? Who is the oldest? 22, 23? I don't even know.
Maybe 27 might be the oldest guy.
No, well, on the team, but of those three midfielders, they're all 22.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
They're on 30, yeah.
So between Pulisic and Reyna and Tim Weah, we have attacking options that we never had. Aronson is a revelation. We're not great at the back. That's going to be a problem in Qatar. But I love this team. I love them in 4 years, especially when we're playing at home in the next World Cup. But I think every U.S. team has been an improvement on the last in a lot of ways. But, geez, I just saw highlights of the 2002 quarterfinal loss to Germany. It's on YouTube. Find it. Landon Donovan was robbed of a game winner by Oliver Kahn in that game. It's one of my most amazing saves I've ever seen. And they had a penalty called, not called, that would have won them the game or tied the game. They went toe to toe with the finalists in 2002 and could have won it. And that was 20 years ago. So this team is better than that. We're continually getting better. The World Cup, it doesn't exist for us to talk about winning it. Only about six countries can actually do that. Maybe in my lifetime, we can get into that conversation, but I'm over the moon that this team is as good as it is and can, I think, you know, get to a quarterfinal, maybe semi.
And what is your prediction? Well, for this World Cup,
I think they're going to squeak out of the group and, probably lose in the round of 16.
Yeah.
They're very young. They're very young. I'm not really sure. I don't think anyone is really sure how good Berhalter will be in the moment, adjusting on the fly to what a game and a group play will require of him. He's done some amazing things, and soccer Twitter has really been on his ass, you know, about this roster. A lot of posing, I think, from people who are trying to act like, you know, they think soccer fans should be acting. It's a little weird. We're still learning, Americans, how to handle soccer Twitter, but it's not clear to me that, you know, if Aaron Long performs badly and they get a draw with Wales, that they don't replace him. Because I think he will start.
You think so?
Yeah, I do.
I'm hoping Tim Ream does.
I hope he does too. I'm a Fulham fan. Ream's been amazing, but just look at it from a practical standpoint. Tim Ream showed up yesterday. Walker Zimmerman and Aaron Long have been training together for 2 weeks. They started both games in September. I just can't see Berhalter backing down. I mean, on that front, he's got to give him a chance to play. I'm talking about Aaron Long here. And if it goes great, great. I'll be the first one in line to applaud it. But it makes me pretty nervous.
Yeah, you're right. You make some good points. I usually want to stick those two CBs in the back, kind of have familiarity. So argument for Tim Ream still out there. We'll see what happens. Which U.S. soccer teams were your favorite? Mine was 2002 U.S. team and the 2009 that made it to the Confederations Final against Brazil. Mm-hmm. What are your top two teams?
I guess I don't think about it that way, but I remember being so much older than you. I remember 2002 probably even better. How old were you? 16?
Around there, yeah. 17,
well, you're 16, old enough, yeah, to appreciate it then. But that was an amazing run out of nowhere. But honestly, with the exception of 2006, where we went out, didn't get through the group, I mean, 2010 supplied some just unbelievable drama. They could have won that game against Ghana and gone to the quarterfinal then as well. 2014 was a great tournament that, you know, if Chris Wondolowski pots that goal against Belgium in the knockout there in the quarterfinal, they've treated us to some really good World Cup drama and opportunity. And geez, if this club did that, they would be right there. But I don't have favorites like that. Maybe I should start thinking about it that way.
Yeah. A lot of good teams out there. 89, obviously. And I was hearing that you were saying we almost qualified to the 82 World Cup, right?
No.
Okay.
We didn't come close to qualifying. That's the thing that blew me away in my research, was like, I knew that we had never qualified for a modern World Cup, but with the exception of the very first qualification in 1953, we didn't even get to the final stage of qualifying. Wow. In 8 consecutive World Cup tries. Part of that was they always stuck us in with Mexico and Canada, and they were just better than us. So we didn't ever get out of that little preliminary group, but we never even came close. The closest we came was 1969. We lost a preliminary playoff with Haiti and would have had to play El Salvador for the right to go. Again, not very close.
Which, if we did qualify for that 1970 World Cup, would things have changed?
Yes.
Earlier?
I'm convinced that they would have. NASL was young and a little wobbly, but it would have been a massive boost to the game. This is something that NASL and the Federation said internally for a long time. They said, if we can just get a team into the World Cup, we're going to get the national team and this tournament on television for 2 weeks. And the public is going to get an understanding of what international team competition is about. And they're going to legitimize soccer in their own minds. And, you know, if something crazy happens and we win a game, oh my God, people will freak out because Americans are as jingoistic as anybody else, maybe more. But it never happened until 1989, and it never really came close to happening. And, you know, it really was, I don't think it would have happened. We wouldn't be where we are today, certainly, if we hadn't qualified in 1989. It would have taken a lot longer. But yeah, 1970, right next door in Mexico, Pele's heyday, maybe the finest World Cup ever played. First World Cup ever televised in color. I mean, it was, yeah, a breakthrough event in so many ways. It would have been a breakthrough event for us, but it wasn't in the cards.
Was the final aired on ABC back then?
It was aired on ABC as part of Wide World of Sports, and they cut away to commercials. It may not have even been live. I don't think it was live. I think they showed highlights. In 74, they did the same thing. They showed highlights of the World Cup on a sort of a Wide World of Sports knockoff that CBS had called CBS Sports Spectacular, I think it was called. And they showed highlights of the final. Even the 1966 World Cup final, that was the first soccer ever aired on American television. It was not live. It was on tape delay and stopping it and, you know, on a Sunday and putting in commercials. It was not a live event. So yeah, the first one I think was 1982, first live World Cup final aired on ABC, and Jim McKay called the game. I remember it.
Unbelievable. In Europe, it was prime time everywhere, live, everyone watching it.
And they cut away for commercials in 1982. I remember that. But
hey,
you know, I wasn't even offended because we were so conditioned to expect commercials. We're like, oh, this can't be a real event if there's no commercials.
And I was reading somewhere that I think U.S. Soccer asked FIFA, I think for the 94 World Cup, hey, can we cut these halves into quarters instead? I think I heard something. I don't remember. I can't pinpoint where it was.
You know, as an American soccer fan and one who's, you know, no spring chicken anymore, I can't tell you for how long I've listened to Americans in bars, perfectly nice people. They love saying things like, you know what this sport needs? You know, they have all sorts of great ideas to improve soccer, you know, cheerleaders and 35-yard offside lines. And most of these ideas are terrible, but Americans feel like they've got it understood. You know, they're so keen, you know, when it comes to observing sport. You know what the sport needs, dot, dot, dot. Then you know the conversation is going to go into some very dangerous territory.
And which the owner of Chelsea, Todd Bowley, he was mentioned about having an all-star game in England, which I doubt that will ever happen.
No, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the all-star game for MLS is sort of a non-entity. It's better when they brought in Liga MX and, you know, and had that sort of fun. I'd like to see that, but just once. I'm more interested in watching the champions, you know, the CONCACAF Champions League, because I want to see how MLS teams stack up against Liga MX. So, but yeah, all-star games, just, you know, they were a big deal when I was a kid, and they just get more meaningless with every passing year. It doesn't even matter what sport is.
Yeah. And that is, we'll see what happens. We finally won the CONCACAF Champions League. So that's definitely a step forward.
Yeah.
Generation Zero. What is the best way for people to buy the book?
They can order it off of Amazon. Just type in Generation Zero and soccer. It'll come right up. Same for BarnesandNoble.com. And you can order it at any independent bookstore across this nation. Just go in and ask for it. They'll order it for you.
And you can see the link to purchase the book in the description. Hal Phillips, what is the best way to reach you online?
Well, let's see. I have a nice companion site for the book called GenZero.halphillips.net. I tweet at Mandarin Hal. My media company is called Mandarin Media, so I'm at Mandarin Hal, and that'll probably do it.
And if you
reach me enough that way,
and any plans for writing more books with you as soccer in the near future, or?
Yes and no. I actually have been talking up a project with my publisher about a history of the U.S.-Mexico rivalry, which I think is the finest derby in world soccer, not for necessarily the quality of the play or the import of the games, but geopolitically, socioeconomically, there's just so much going on with those games. But, you know, they just did that. Amazon just put what's called Rivals. I saw that, and part of me was, that'd be good to watch. And I'm like, what the hell? They stole my idea. You know, it's, but a book is a book. And I'm sure that while the series is going to be good, I guess it comes out on the 24th of November. I'm going to watch it.
Yeah, next week. So during the World Cup. But I've definitely write that book if you can.
That'd be great. It's, I have a lot of relatives who are Mexican Americans and live in Mexico. And I've poked around with the idea of actually writing the U.S.-Mexico rivalry book with a Mexican journalist, someone who could really get in there and get the Mexican side of the story. And it's funny, Santi, because I had an amazing conversation with this fellow for a couple hours one night, and it felt real, you know, and he was into it. You could just tell. It's a great, great storyline and a really, really interesting book to write. He calls me back a week later, and he's like, you know what, Hal, I'm not sure that this is going to work. I'm like, why? And he goes, because Mexicans won't read this book. And I'm like, well, why not? And he's like, because Mexicans absolutely hate the fact that the U.S. is good now. They hate it. They will not write about it. They will not read it. And he's like, I'm just telling you, because I think this is a great idea, but that is the truth. And I think he's right, which just sort of underscores how fun this rivalry really is. But you know, I could get by with U.S. sales. Maybe the U.S. sales of the book would be good enough that it wouldn't matter.
Yeah, definitely. And Mexican definitely don't like the U.S. I have spoken to a few Mexican fans, and definitely their number one rival is the U.S. Hal Phillips, author of Generation Zero, I appreciate you coming on to the Sportscast.
My pleasure, Santi. Thanks for having me on.